Well, we continue our studies in the book of Judges, first of all today, and then we move on into the book of Ruth. And it will really help you to have the text of these two books in front of your eyes, because we're looking at some rather extensive sections. In the first of our two periods together, we look at Judges 17 through to 21. That's the entire last five chapters of the book. And the key text, if you want to fasten your eye upon one and underline it in red, is the very last text of the book, the very last verse of the book, 21:25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. It's a truism, of course, to say that the rivers of history run red with blood, but why do they do so? There's always been a dream amongst humankind that eventually we would find some world where there was no more violence, no more war. But over all the centuries that dream has fired political imagination, it has never yet come true. In fact, ironically, our 20th century has witnessed more bloody carnage, I think, than any century that's preceded it. It was George Hegel, wasn't it, who wrote at the beginning of the 19th century, "History teaches us that people have learnt nothing from history." Why are we so incorrigible? Why are we so unable to solve our social problems without recourse to violence? Now, as I say, that isn't a new question. People have always asked it. In fact, it was a question, I suspect, that was on the mind of the author of this book of Judges, which we've been looking at over the last few weeks. Ancient Israel, too, had lived through centuries of bloodshed. Ever since her people had emerged from their nomadic wanderings in the desert to settle in the land of Canaan, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, her history had been repeatedly punctuated by war. In early days, those wars had been with other tribes that contested Israel's territorial ambitions in the area. And we've noticed, haven't we, a cyclical pattern that emerged during that period, a pattern which our author has described for us in the preceding chapters of this book. Periods of peace and prosperity alternate with each other. Periods of military conflict and foreign domination. You could argue, I suppose, that warfare in that situation was unavoidable. Israel had to defend herself against peoples like the Midianites and the Philistines, or she simply couldn't have survived as a nation. The armies of Israel were usually outnumbered and faced by other peoples who were militarily superior. That the battles were won at all, our author regularly ascribes to the fact that God raised up judges to deliver her. Charismatically endowed individuals like Gideon and Jephthah and Samson, who led the people in war for their salvation. So our author is certainly no pacifist. In situations where foreign armies invaded or oppressed the nation, a war of self-defense, though regrettable, was justified, he seems to suggest. He clearly believes, in fact, that God could be trusted to intervene on his people's side in such conflicts. However, something else was going on during this period of Israel's history too. Another pattern was also being generated. Not this time a cyclical pattern of war and peace, but a linear pattern of steadier decline into spiritual and moral decadence. Violence was very much a part of that pattern too, only this time there could be no justification for it. If you put those two patterns together, of course, what you get is a downward spiral. And if you've been following this series, you will recall that we have repeatedly seen evidence of that spiral throughout the book. Take the story of Gideon, for instance, we looked at last time. He successfully delivered Israel from the Midianites. But in the wake of that triumph, he himself opened the door to a renaissance of idolatry in the country by erecting that golden oracle, which the Jews quickly started to venerate. So it's no surprise to be told in 8 verse 33 that no sooner had Gideon died than Israel was immersed in the worship of pagan Canaanite deities once again. Even more sinister, though, was that report in chapter 9 that Abimelech, one of Gideon's many sons, murdered all his brothers in order to secure political power for himself. Even at that early point in the book, one begins to wonder whether a threat even more serious than the Midianites may not be lurking within Israel herself, rather than outside her borders. And this same pattern of internal degeneration was detectable again in the story of Jephthah. He too, you remember, successfully delivered Israel, this time from the threat of the Ammonite army. But a foolish vow that owed more to pagan superstition than to faith led him to commit an act of human sacrifice involving his own daughter. And in an ironic aftermath of his victory over the Ammonites, which we didn't get time to look at last time in chapter 12, his Gileadite forces engage in quite unnecessary bloodshed against their own fellow Israelites from Ephraim. Well, by the time we get to the story of Samson in chapters 13 to 16, it's quite clear that these spirit-anointed champions whom God raises up to deliver his people from their enemies have themselves become a part of this pattern of moral decline. For Samson, notwithstanding all his victories over the Philistine menace, is a churlish fool, given to spiteful adolescent pranks and totally driven by his sex hormones. He offers no spiritual leadership or moral leadership to the nation whatsoever. He's just a solitary Rambo who pursues his own private vendettas. And significantly, after him, no more judges appear. The cyclical pattern seems to have come to an end. No more do we hear of God stepping in to turn the tide of history by raising up a judge. Instead, the downward spiral of increasing decadence has straightened out into something perilously close to a vertical free fall. So before he brings his book to an end, our author tells us two more stories intended to illustrate just how rapidly things were going downhill in the country by the end of this period of the Judges. We haven't got time to look at these chapters in detail, which is a pity because in many ways they are a masterpiece of our author's narrative art, well worth study just as examples of Hebrew literature. The key thing they both have in common, however, is that unlike the stories of Gideon and Jephthah and Samson, which have dominated the middle parts of the book, there is absolutely no foreign threat to Israel's security at all forming the background to these final incidents. These stories are exclusively about the internal state of Israel. And a sorry state it is, as you'll see. Now, the first story, which we encounter in chapters 17 and 18, is the somewhat entertaining tale of a guy called Micah and his superstitious attempts to make sure of God's blessing. The opening scene is set in chapter 17, verses 1 to 5. A man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and about which I heard you utter a curse, I have that silver with me. I took it." Then his mother said, "The Lord bless you, my son." When he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, she said, "I solemnly consecrate my silver to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a cast idol. I will give it back to you." So he returned the silver to his mother, and she took the 200 shekels of silver and gave them to a silversmith who made them into an image and an idol, and they were put in Micah's house. Now this man, Micah, had a shrine, and he made an ephod and some idols and installed one of his sons as his priest. Well, compressed very tightly in these five opening verses, our author explains to us how it was that this fellow Micah came to have a private shrine in his own home. It was from the start a morally and theologically dubious situation. The man had stolen a very large sum of money from his mother. She, it seems, partly no doubt to expedite its recovery, had announced that the sum had actually been consecrated to God. And since that made it God's property, a divine curse was sure to rest on anybody who had stolen it. Now Micah, who, as I've already hinted, was a rather superstitious fellow, decided thereupon he'd better give the cash back. Whereupon his mother generously renounces the curse. "The Lord bless you, my son," she says. So far, so good. But we soon discover that Micah's mother is as theologically ill-informed as her superstitious son. For she immediately proceeds to reconsecrate the money for the purpose of constructing an idolatrous shrine, complete with silver image. Indeed, judging from verse 5, the shrine that results from this financial investment had a number of valuable objects in it, all for the purpose of religious devotion, and all, of course, strictly prohibited by the covenant law of Moses. Not satisfied with his shrine, however, we are told that Micah went on to install one of his own sons as priest to this private cult. Again, a totally irregular procedure, since according to Moses, only members of the tribe of Levi could function as priests. Now, to give him credit, Micah seems to have recognized this breach of orthodoxy, and that no doubt explains what happens next in verse 7. A young Levite, note, from Bethlehem in Judah, who had been living within the clan of Judah, left that town in search of some other place to stay, and on his way he came to Micah's house in the hill country of Ephraim. Micah asked him, "Where are you from?" "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah," he said, "and I'm looking for a place to stay." Then Micah said to him, "Live with me and be my father and priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver a year, your clothes and your food." Now, superficially, at any rate, one could argue that Micah's intentions here were good. He realized his son was not a proper priest, and he leapt at this opportunity to secure the services of somebody more kosher. But once again, the whole thing reeks of heresy. What sort of priest hires himself out to a private individual in this fashion, in biblical religion anyway? And what sort of person thinks they can manipulate God into guaranteeing them prosperity by such a mercenary arrangement? That was the thought in Micah's mind is made quite clear in verses 12 to 13, you see. Then Micah installed the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. And Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since this Levite has become my priest." Here's as I said at the start, you see, Micah's actions owe far more to superstition than biblical faith. Now, in very typical fashion, our author does not spell out his disapproval of Micah's actions directly. But in a way characteristic of Old Testament narrative at its literary best, in chapter 18, he simply goes on to tell us the sequel to the story. And he invites us quietly to draw our own conclusions. The sequel is this. A spying party of 5 Israelites from the tribe of Dan appear on the scene. They and their clans had not yet secured a territorial base in Canaan, so they were on the lookout for vacant property. Passing by Micah's place, they hear an unfamiliar southern accent, and on inquiring, discover it belongs to the young priest from Bethlehem. Delighted to have the services of this bona fide divine oracle so unexpectedly available to them, they consult him for advice on their hunt for a suitable homeland. "Don't worry," says the priest. "God says you're on a winner." And with that divine endorsement ringing in their ears, the spies continue in their search for a suitable homeland for their people. 18 verse 7. So the 5 men left and came to Laish, where they saw that the people were living in safety, like the Sidonians, unsuspecting and secure. And since their land lacked nothing, they were prosperous. Also, they lived a long way from the Sidonians and had no relationship with anyone else. A quiet and remote town then, populated by Sidonian merchants, with no army, nor any access to defensive support, either from Sidon itself or any other ally. To these land-hungry Danites, Laish looked like a juicy sitting duck, a bit like Kuwait before the armed might of Saddam Hussein, perhaps. There should have been a problem. God had never given the Israelites any mandate to attack Sidonians, nor at this time did Sidon pose any military threat to Israel's borders. The Sidonians were a peaceful, mercantile people. They had no reason to fear anyone, for in general their activities prospered the lands where they lived through their economic activity. They had no enemies, they thought. Sidon then may have, Laish may then have been a sitting duck, but she was not fair game. Not according to biblical law. The only one who might have given these Danites a bad conscience about seizing such a city would have been God. But you see, a priest with a silver oracle to consult had assured them that they need fear no such divine disapproval. They were on a winner. As a result, their recommendation when they return home to their clans and report the results of their reconnaissance is grimly predictable. Verses 8 to 10. When they returned to Zorah and Eshtol, their brothers asked them, "How did you find things?" They answered, "Come on, let's attack them. We have seen that the land is very good. Aren't you going to do something? Don't hesitate to go there and take it over. When you get there, you'll find an unsuspecting people and a spacious land that God has put into your hands." En route to performing this piece of ethnic cleansing, the Danite militia once again pass by Micah's home. The five spies tell their colleagues about Micah's shrine with the valuable silver image and the priest who had given them such helpful advice. And plunder being their business, the Danites reason that Micah's idols are far too good to be monopolized by him alone. They decide to take them into public ownership, without compensation, of course. As for the young Levite, they stifle whatever muted objections he might be murmuring by giving him an offer he couldn't refuse. Promotion from ministering at Micah's pathetic little private chapel to a major tribal shrine at the new provincial capital of Dan, which they would shortly be constructing on the ruins of Laish. Well, the priest, as you might expect from his previous record of financial self-interest, is lured by this prospect of a sizable rise in salary. And so in verses 22 to 26, our author presents us with the rather comic scene of Micah and his household racing after the Danite forces to complain about their outrageous breach of the law of private property. "You've stolen my gods and my priest," wails Micah, verse 24. Somewhat in the injured tone of a child asking a bigger boy if he can have his ball back. "You'd better keep your mouth shut," replied the bullying Danites. "Some of our warriors have a rather short fuse, you know. We wouldn't want anyone getting hurt, would we?" So pathetic Micah, who you remember began by stealing his mother's silver, at the end of the story is left empty-handed, the victim of theft himself. One of those little ironies our author loves. As for the poor Sidonians, verse 27 to 28. Then they took what Micah had made and his priest and went on to Laish against a peaceful and unsuspecting people. They attacked them with the sword and burned down their city. There was no one to rescue them because they lived a long way from Sidon and had no relationship with anyone else. Do you see how in the eloquence of simple narrative our author expresses the shame he feels at what had taken place? The Danites don't even seem to have offered them peace terms as the law of Moses required. It was a ruthless surprise attack, totally unprovoked. And they take no prisoners. Our author has just one more observation to add to our general sense of ill-ease at this whole incident. He could have told us this much earlier, but with a storyteller's eye to maximizing audience shock, he leaves it until the very end of chapter 18 verse 30. There the Danites set up for themselves the idols, and Jonathan, son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. Well, now there's a shock. He knew his name all along, but didn't tell him. Micah's priest was none other than a grandson of Moses. A pious Jewish scribe, it seems, was so outraged by this suggestion, he inserted a letter N in the ancient manuscript in order to make it read son of Manasseh rather than of Moses, and some English versions follow that reading. But there are very strong reasons, I think, for accepting the rendering of the NIV, that it is Moses, not Manasseh, who is in view here. Could there be any clearer evidence of the decadence of Israelite religion than that the direct descendants of Moses himself were now ministering at a shrine that was corrupted by superstition and idolatry in a city that had been captured in total defiance of Moses' moral law? Tacitly, you see, our author is showing us the downward spiral had turned into a vertical slide. But as a Hollywood director might say, you ain't seen nothing yet. Micah's tale is an amusing farce compared to the gruesome and barbarous story that concludes this book in chapters 19 to 21. Now a Levite, 19:1, who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim, took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Interesting that again the leading characters originate in Bethlehem, and that once again the story features a Levite. It's not impossible that our author feels there's some connection with the story of Micah. Could this Levite of chapter 19 be once again none other than Jonathan, Moses' grandson? The text doesn't say so. But it does tell us that he lived in a remote area of the hill country of Ephraim, just like Micah did. So the tacit possibility is there. Anyway, follow the story with me. He took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but she was unfaithful to him. She left him and went back to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah. After she'd been there for 4 months, her husband went to her to persuade her to return. He had with him his servant and 2 donkeys. She took him into her father's house, and when her father saw him, he gladly welcomed him. As you may remember from an earlier part of this book, a concubine in the ancient world was a kept mistress who remained legally part of her parents' family and therefore enjoyed none of the rights which a wife possessed by law. Scholars are a bit unclear about whether the text implies that this concubine actually had an affair with some other man or whether there was just a domestic quarrel. Anyway, the upshot was that she went home to mother, or father, as our author tends to put it. And the Levite, peeved by her desertion, eventually goes after her. A little bit of the old charm, he says to himself, and she'll come back to me. When he gets to her home in Bethlehem, of course, he meets her father, and very quickly the two men seem to hit it off. In fact, they spend the next 5 days having one long stag party, with plenty of good food and drink to help the convivial atmosphere along. Each time the Levite begins to think he ought to be making tracks for home, his host dissuades him. Indeed, by the 5th day, you begin to get the feeling that the Levite is saying to himself, if I don't leave now, I never will. Thus it was that he, his concubine, and his servant finish up leaving Bethlehem for the long journey back north rather late in the day. In verse 11, they pass the town of Jebus, a city, of course, which David would later capture and make into his capital city and rename Jerusalem. But at this time in history, Jebus is still a pagan fortress, and though the Levite contemplates seeking refuge for the night there, he dismisses the idea, feeling it would be unsafe. So he travels on in the sparse remaining daylight to reach Gibeah, an Israelite town in the tribal territory of Benjamin. Ironically, as events turn out, he would have been better advised to seek pagan hospitality in Jebus. As soon as they arrive in Gibeah, one senses that something is very wrong. There is a sinister look in everybody's eye as this small party sit on their suitcases in the town square. Nobody offers them accommodation for the night, something which was a reprehensible breach of etiquette in the ancient Middle East, indeed still today. Could it be that people from up north are not welcome down here in the south, in Benjamin? Eventually, one old man does take pity on them. Significantly, he's not a local Benjaminite. He's a northerner like them. "For goodness sake," he says, in a tone that sounds disturbingly like a warning, "don't spend the night in the square, whatever you do." Later that evening, the reason for his anxiety on the behalf becomes quite plain. 19, verse 22. While they were enjoying themselves in his home, some of the wicked men of that city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him." The Levite escapes homosexual rape by this lewd mob. But if you continue the story, you'll discover he does so only by throwing his own concubine out of the door as a substitute sex object for them to spend their violent lust upon. And after a night of what must have been horrifyingly vicious sexual abuse, this poor woman staggers back to the old man's dwelling, but never manages to knock on the door. For when the Levite opens the door at dawn, he discovers her dead body lying on the doorstep. "Get up, let's go," he says to her, verse 28. But there was no answer. Now what he does next will sound quite bizarre in your ears, almost like a scene from some horror movie. Verse 28. "The man put her corpse on his donkey and set out for home. When he reached home, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them into all the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it said, 'Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Think about it. Consider it. Tell us what to do.'" And to understand this, you have to realize that Israel was a federation of tribes joined together by a blood covenant. In an ancient covenant, a sacrificial animal was sometimes cut in pieces as a witness to the mutual promise that the parties were making and the seriousness of those promises. The logic of such a covenant and such a sacrifice may well have been something like this, that those who participated in the covenant were taking upon themselves a kind of self-invoked curse. "If I break the terms of this covenant relationship, then may God make me like this slaughtered animal." What the Levite then is doing by this macabre theatrical is to use his concubine's corpse in a quite unprecedented way as a gruesome reminder to the 12 tribes of Israel of the allegiance they owed as 12 tribes of a single nation to the blood of the covenant. He's summoning, in other words, the Israelite tribal muster by the most powerful of symbols. But he's doing so this time not in order to face some external aggressor, some Philistine or Ammonite or Midianite army, as in earlier generations. He's doing it to seek justice in a matter of civil dispute with a tribe from their own number. And as 20 verse 1 tells us, his appeal was successful. "Then all the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came out as one man and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah." That the Levites' protest could command this kind of wide response, I think, strongly suggests that he was a man of considerable influence. Our suspicion that he may well have been Archbishop Jonathan from the new diocese of Dan in the north is perhaps reinforced. But if so, he displays none of Grandfather Moses' political prudence. He makes it quite clear that he expects vengeance on the inhabitants of Gibeah for this outrage. And the tribes agree, at least 11 of them do. The tribe of Benjamin, to which you recall Gibeah belonged, remains loyal to its fellow clansmen. They refuse to give up the gang of rapists responsible for the crime, and instead they make it quite clear they are prepared to fight for their right to administer justice, independent of such interference by the other tribes. The result is that the whole thing escalates into a full-scale civil war. I wish we had time to read together our author's brilliant account of the fighting, because it is a masterpiece. Suffice it to say that it takes 3 days for the Federal Army of Israel to capture Gibeah, and by the end, the total body count is numbered in tens of thousands. What's more, in a quite unnecessary punitive atrocity, the entire civilian population of the town of Gibeah is put to the sword, including women and children. It all smacks of something disturbingly like Bosnia or Rwanda, quite frankly. And in a final ironic postscript, our author tells us in chapter 21 how when they had at last cooled off, the Israelites began to realize they had gone decidedly over the top. For what they had done in their hot-blooded pursuit of vengeance was darn near eliminate the whole tribe of Benjamin. The famous 12 tribes would become 11, a much less propitious number. Somehow they must retrieve the situation, and practically speaking, that meant finding some women to become wives of the tattered remnants of the Benjaminite army, for all their own women, you remember, had been slaughtered. But there was a problem in finding such women, for the families of Israel had taken an oath at the time of the tribal muster at Mizpah that in view of what had happened to the Levites' concubine, they would never again give their daughters in marriage to a man of Benjamin. "We can't break our promise now, can we?" they reasoned. "So how do we get out of this?" "Oh," said someone, "it's easy. We took another vow at Mizpah as well, don't you remember? We made a lot of vows there. We also agreed that anybody who didn't support us in the fight against Benjamin would be put to death. Well, I happen to know that absolutely nobody took part in the civil war from Jabesh Gilead. So all we have to do is go over there, put all the men and women in that city to death in fulfillment of our second vow, but spare the unmarried daughters this time. Then we can invite the remnant of Benjamin to help themselves. Since they're not our daughters, we will not be breaking our first vow, you see." So that's what they did. Nor was this the end of the casuistic contortions of their moral logic. But unfortunately, there weren't quite enough virgins in Jabesh Gilead to go round. There were a few Benjaminite veterans who still lacked a wife. So someone had another bright idea. "Oh, at the next harvest festival, just tell the Benjaminites to abduct any available young female they fancy. We will just undertake to turn a blind eye to it. Everyone knows these things happen at harvest time. And since we're not actually giving the girls to them, we shan't be breaking our vow." Once again, our author doesn't spell out his horror at these crazy antics. He leaves us, his readers, to draw our own conclusions. And again, it isn't difficult to sense the shame and exasperation he feels that the history of his people should be checkered with such acts of unfettered violence and moral blindness. Tacitly, he asks the question, why? Why is it that history always goes this way? Why were things going downhill in this appalling fashion? Nothing that happens in these two stories, you see, is new, is it? In fact, there is a disturbing and ironic resonance with some earlier Bible stories. This rape of the Levite's concubine, for instance, has a number of clear parallels to an incident in the life of Abraham's nephew, Lot, recorded in Genesis 19. There are a number of reasons for believing that our author is deliberately evoking resonances with that older story in the way he tells his story. But the city in question that time was not Gibeah, but Sodom. Sodom, the most notorious hellhole of all history. The implication is embarrassingly plain, you see. The kind of things that Hebrew storybooks associated with Sodom was now becoming commonplace in Israelite cities. And the nation seemed unable to find either the moral resolve or the juristic prudence to eliminate such crime from the community without unleashing totally disproportionate forces of violence that threatened to undermine the political unity of the whole country. Where have we heard this story before? We've heard it in our newspapers again and again within the last few years. Why is it we human beings seem so incapable of resolving social problems without recourse to violence? Our author does believe he knows the answer. I've said on a number of occasions in these lectures, he is very reluctant to interject interpretive comments in his narrative. He prefers, as all great storytellers do, to just let us draw our own conclusions by our own involvement, emotionally and rationally, in what's going on. But four times in these chapters we're looking at, he departs from his normal policy and inserts an interpretive comment of his own. All the more significant are these interruptions because they are so rare and because each time his comment is identical. Let me point them out to you. In 17, verse 6, at the commencement of the story of Micah. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. In 18:1, before the Danite attack on Laish, in those days, Israel had no king. In 19, verse 1, before the rape of the concubine. In those days, Israel had no king. And most significant of all, as the postscript to the entire book, in 21, verse 25, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Here, then, according to the inspired historian, is the reason for Israel's sorry decline. It was the lack of a monarchy. Now, can he be serious? We British know something about the monarchy, and most of us are a bit disillusioned about it at the moment. Is he really suggesting that a royal dynasty is the magic cure for the kind of moral and spiritual decay that he's been illustrating in these stories? Now, clearly, law and order was at a low ebb in Israel. A king would provide a centralized source of authority that potentially, at least, could counteract anarchic elements in the society. There's wisdom in what he says in that sense, of course. But he's surely not so naive as to think that the political institution of monarchy is incorruptible. Certainly any later Jewish reader would have known from painful experience that kings were no more a solution to that downward spiral than the judges had been. Idolatry, social injustice, criminal violence, sexual immorality, civil war, all these things are features of the later history of Israel, and her kings play no small part in their prominence. No, our author is not naive about monarchy. This fourfold comment of his has to be read against the background of the books of Samuel and Kings, which I think he is quite consciously contributing his own historical record. When you set it against that background, you realize he has a particular style of monarchy in mind. Indeed, my own
suspicion is he has a particular king in mind. And he has given us, I suspect, a subtle clue to that king's identity in the geographical association of these two stories. Bethlehem. If you wait until after coffee, you'll find that the next book in the Bible, Ruth, continues to find in Bethlehem a focus of interest. We will discover there that amidst the sordid and violent days of the judges, not everybody was locked into the pursuit of self-interest. A girl called Ruth, significantly of pagan parentage, was quietly demonstrating with Israel a nobler lifestyle than the soap opera of sex and violence that seems to have been the norm in the rest of the country. And she is destined to become the great-grandmother of the king our author is looking for. David. Yes, Bethlehem would be his birthplace. Set this book against the whole of the Bible as a background, and it's clear that what our author is really getting at is this: that the root of us human beings is that we do not want to be ruled. There was no king in Israel. Everyone did as he thought fit. We want to follow our own devices. Like Frank Sinatra, we want to do it our way. We have our religious ideas, as Micah did, and we want to express them. We have our ambitions, as the Danites did, and we want to pursue them. We have our sexual desires, as the men of Gibeah did, and we want to satisfy them. We have our ideas of justice, as the tribal master at Mizpah did, and we want to execute them. What we do not want to do is bow our necks to the rule of God. Oh, God's all right if he keeps his place, baptizing our enterprises with reassuring promises of blessing. But a God who has ideas of his own, plans of his own, desires of his own, justice of his own, a God like that might collide with our ideas and our ambitions and our desires and our justice, and we don't want that. We want to do as we see fit. This, of course, is precisely what the Bible as a whole means by sin. Sin is not just a label we attach to certain kinds of prohibited act. It is, in the Bible, a mindset of moral independence, a refusal to submit to the sovereign rule of God over our lives. All the acts of criminal and anarchistic violence that this world mourns are the result of such sin, says the Bible. The reason the river of history runs red with blood is sin. And there is no simple answer to it, says the Bible. Because that sin principle is embedded in every one of us. That idiosyncratic moral independence is embedded in our social conditioning. It's embedded in our very genetic makeup. We cannot escape it. We've been that way, says the Bible, since the very infancy of our race. What's the answer? The answer, says our author, is a king. No, not any king. A king like David, born in Bethlehem, but greater even than he. For even David, we shall discover, the sacred historian will go on to tell us, had his faults. And even he was a man of blood. Now, the king we need must be a king who somehow stands outside this heritage of willful, sinful rebellion the rest of us share. What was it he announced when he began his public ministry? The kingdom is here. That's what he had come to bring. That's why he had to come from outside. No human judge, no human king could deliver us. Though in all of these stories, the Bible is preparing us for the thought, such a deliverer is what we need. Though a deliverer that must surpass all of them. No human judge, no human king can deliver us from this spiral of wickedness in which we are trapped. If there is to be any hope for this sin-sick race of ours, it lies in a different kind of king. But he too will be born in Bethlehem. Another of those delicious ironies in which the Bible so much delights.